It was so wonderful. Suddenly, our life instantly changed.
You are listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness, your number one resource for practical tips and insights, empowering you and your family to live well with Alzheimer's. Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Alzheimer's Podcast. I'm Mike Good of Togetherness. Welcome back for another podcast where my goal is always to empower you to maintain a positive experience, reduce and eliminate the need for medications, and make your time together with those you care for the best it can be. Today I have a special treat. Joining me are the co-authors of Living with Dying, Yana Beecham and Katie Ortlip. If you listened to my previous episodes, then you've heard me talk about maintaining a positive experience, and that means up until the end. But most of us are uncomfortable talking about death, and because of that, I believe we aren't well equipped to make this phase as comfortable and positive as possible. That's why I've asked these ladies to join me for a conversation about hospice care. First, let me share a little background about them. Author Yana Beecham and nurse Katie Ortlip began as friends and neighbors. However, when Yana's 90-year-old father was told his prostate cancer had spread to his bones, Yana became his caregiver, while Katie became his hospice social worker. Together, during this emotional time, they became even closer and shared insights on end-of-life care, as well as how to have the best death possible. And their joint writing journey began. Their new book, Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers, is a comprehensive field guide for those caring for a loved one at the end of life. Hello, ladies, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike. Great to be here.
Yeah, hi, Mike.
Yeah, thanks for being here today. And I must say, I really enjoy your book from what I haven't read it in full, but I have found myself, due to the ease of its reading style, I have found myself carrying around the house and focused on the hospice for this conversation, but looking at other topics in the book, I must say I really enjoy the way this book is laid out for people.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, we wanted to make it be, bullet-pointed, bolded, boxed, easy to read for someone who doesn't have time to read.
Yeah, and as I told you when we first met, that was kind of me, because I really don't like to read. So for me to be carrying around and actually be reading through things says a lot about that.
Thanks for the compliment.
So why don't we go ahead and let's get started by having you just explain to our listeners, when should a patient choose hospice and what can hospice do for you?
Well, first of all, I must say that most people come to hospice too late. So I always say it's never too early to have hospice care. But having said that, most people are referred to hospice when something has just happened. They've been hospitalized. They've just gotten a terminal diagnosis. Their symptoms are getting worse, maybe increased pain, and they're finding that they're having to call the doctor a lot. And they've made a decision that they do not want to go to the hospital. They want comfort care at home, good quality of life care. And I think most people wait far too late. And facilities where people are, we may have patients who are in facilities like nursing homes or assisted living. The staff there really like to have hospice care, because if someone falls but doesn't have an injury, or if someone's not eating or developing other symptoms, they don't have to send them to the emergency room. So facilities really like the hospice support, so they can keep the people right there in their homes. Sometimes it's the families that really need the care. So we may have patients that are reluctant to go on hospice, and I may say to them, yes, but your family needs us. Your family really needs the support right now. So that's something I want to emphasize, is that it's not only for the patient. The patient may be doing relatively well, but the family needs the guidance and the support so that they can work with their loved one to have the best quality of life until they die. But certainly if a patient is starting to have worsening symptoms, maybe pain, agitation, difficulty breathing, they should really have hospice come in, because we could keep them at home and keep them more comfortable. And we do have a holistic approach. So we have nurses, social workers, chaplains, volunteers, bath aides, even massage therapists that can come in, you know, depending on what the family and the patient need. So we treat the whole family, providing, you know, support physically, emotionally, and spiritually. If you have questions, you can always call your local hospice and find out more information.
I like that in your book, I read, it says, and I did, you know, I'm learning a lot here. It says hospice is not necessarily a place, but it's a way of caring. Yes. And I like how that it made that got me thinking and I had a little realization there. And also that the, as you said, it helps the families because they also can get support beyond after their loved ones passed on, I saw.
Yes, we have bereavement follow-up. So we send out mailings periodically, you know, like newsletters about grief and other things. We also have support groups and individual counseling if the family feels they need that. But they can call us anytime. I get calls sometimes a few months later because sometimes that it becomes harder. Oftentimes the grief, once some time goes by, and they just need guidance as to, you know, whether what they're feeling, you know, is normal. And I usually say, yes, that's normal. Or that maybe they need to go to a support group at that time.
Mm-hmm. That's a great service. I'm so happy to hear that that's provided. In the same chapter on hospice in your book, you talk about some myths of hospice. And I must admit, I had some of these misconceptions as well. And do you think it's these myths that also contribute to why people delay going into hospice? And if so, maybe you can talk about two or three of the top ones you feel are it's important for our families to better understand.
Yeah, Mike, I really think that they do prevent people. The biggest one that is that people, a lot of people believe that you have to be very close to dying to have hospice, that if the doctor calls on hospice, it means, oh, I have a few days or a week. And there could be nothing farthest from the truth. We have people in hospice sometimes for just a few days because they're referred very late. But we have also had patients for months or even a year or two.
My dad was on hospice for 6 months.
In the book, I realized from what it said also is that you don't have to be bedridden. You can, or house-ridden. You can also be, or housebound. You can be on hospice, but still be doing bucket list items.
Yeah. I had a patient who went on an Alaskan cruise. He went back east and stood at his daughter's wedding. He had goals for himself. And, you know, we have plenty of patients. If you saw them walking down the street, you would never guess they're on hospice. And we really encourage people to live as fully as possible. And we sometimes help plan in their trips. I helped one young mother who was dying take her kids to Disneyland. I set her up with a group to help pay for it. And that was her biggest dream, was to take her kids to Disneyland. So, you know, we're really more for about living than dying.
That's wonderful.
It's really, Katie, isn't it just that it's when people don't want to go through any more treatments and the curative stuff. They just want to live their life.
Yeah,
they can.
Yes, to go on hospice, people are finished with curative, aggressive treatment. Maybe there are no more options, or they've decided, I don't want to go to hospitals anymore. I don't want to go into clinics and have treatments. I really want to focus on comfort and quality of life and live my life as well and as full as possible, knowing that they have a terminal illness. So that is really something I try to stress when I meet with people.
Mm. That's great. What are a couple other myths that people may have?
Another one, as you said, is sometimes people believe that when they go on hospice, they have to leave their homes and go somewhere, go to this hospice home or this hospice place. Most of my patients are living in their own homes. And so we listen to our patients, and most of them say they want to stay at home to die. And so that is what we work toward, even though it's not always possible. And another myth is that only people with cancer can have hospice care. Mm. Anybody with an end-of-life terminal diagnosis in the last 6 months or so can have hospice care, including people with end-stage Alzheimer's, end-stage Parkinson's, heart disease, lung disease, a whole range of illnesses or conditions. Someone can just be at the very end of their life, and they're not eating anymore, they're not drinking anymore. And so the doctor has determined that they're probably getting close to dying, and then they call us in. So it's not just for people with cancer.
I didn't personally have that misconception, but I can see how a lot of people would. You also, I believe, talked about morphine or something related to morphine possibly being a myth?
Yeah, there are a lot of myths around morphine as well. It just has a really bad reputation because people think of addiction. They think that when people start on morphine, they're going to die immediately, that we're going to give them this big dose of morphine and they're going to die. Or they think that they're going to become kind of crazy or loopy if they take morphine. And all these myths aren't true. People use morphine for months and sometimes years before they die. It's really an amazing medication. The molecular configuration of morphine is very similar to our own natural endorphins, painkillers that our body makes. So that's why it's used, because it binds to the pain receptors in our brain the way that our own endorphins do. And we can go as high as we need to go, but we usually start on very tiny doses and we adjust it as people need more. So we don't overdo it. We don't knock people out. And it's also a great drug for difficulty breathing. It relaxes the airways and it works on the respiratory center of the brain so that you're not feeling that anxiety that people get when they're short of breath. So it has some really great uses.
Okay. What's going through my mind now is we talked about people caring for their loved ones at home, and now we're giving them morphine. Mm-hmm. How does the family, because I believe I read that a misconception is that there's a nurse on duty there all the time or something, but how does that, you must have to train the family on how to administer the morphine.
Yeah, we do a lot of teaching. We have teaching sheets. If someone is on hospice, there's a nurse available to talk to 24/7. And if there's an urgent need, the nurse can come out to the home. But so the family, if they have some concerns or they're not sure whether they can give more morphine, they can always call and talk to the nurse for instructions. So we do a lot of teaching and educating. And we have the nurse writes out sheets on how much morphine to give, how often, and if it's not working anymore, the family can call and the nurse can make adjustments. So there's always guidance. If a patient isn't on hospice, it's more difficult. At that point, they probably just have to call their doctor. But, you know, it's amazing how much caregivers learn, how quickly mm-hmm. they learn. And most of the time, the families really rise to the occasion and do a great job.
That's true. They've especially, well, I'm biased, or I'm not sure if that's the word I want to use, but for the Alzheimer's and dementia caregivers, they've likely been through one heck of a situation up until this point. So they're pretty strong and capable people. So that's great that you give the training and help them through those things and do that for them. And in your book, you have an entire chapter on pain. I believe it's titled Pain, the Biggest Fear.
Yes.
And I believe that's definitely something that would worry a lot of caregivers. And the chapter starts out by saying the ultimate priority should be good pain control.
That's one of the biggest worries that people have.
You know, but sometimes, especially when the person has dementia, understanding and being able to identify that pain, their pains can be more challenging, right? So, but I believe Yana gave an example in her book of how her father would say, "I'm suffering from every pain known to medical science."
Yes. You'd say, "Are you in pain?" "Yeah, I'm in pain." Yeah. But trying to identify it was, there's techniques that actually Katie taught me. You know, you ask specifically, do you say, does it hurt here? Does it hurt here? Does the pain feel sharp? Is it an achy kind of pain? You know, you can kind of identify location by just, you know, pointing to the body parts and things like that. But my experience with hospice around my father's pain was when he first got his prostate cancer had metastasized to bone cancer. He was in terrible, terrible pain. It was so awful. And all of the tests, like getting on a X-ray machine or having an MRI, all of that was just agonizing for him. And so finally, so at first the doctors offered him kind of some sort of drugs that really made him loopy. I mean, really loopy. And confused, you know, he tried to leave the house through the fireplace. And
oh my.
I talked to Katie about it. I said, I think he's just getting ditzy. He's not getting any pain relief. And Katie said, well, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of reducing the swelling that's pushing on the nerves. She goes, give him, what'd you say, 4 Advil or 8?
4 Advil, a couple times a day.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes opioids aren't always the right medication, or they just throw opioids at people when actually with bone pain, anti-inflammatories are better. So when Yana put him on the Advil, we were able to reduce his opioid. And so he got less confused because he was on too much opioid that wasn't helping his pain.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing that hospice does.
And yeah. I could see in that instance how some people might just say, well, it's the dementia, when in fact it's this inappropriate medication. I tell a similar story in another podcast about a gentleman's wife who was on pain medication for her back, and it basically sucked the life out of her. And when they finally got in to see the geriatric psychiatrist, that doctor, she immediately changed the pain medication, and his wife came back and was able to cook again, and they were going to soccer games for their grandchildren. So to our listeners, you know, I can never reiterate enough how important it is to get the medications properly reviewed, and don't just assume it's the dementia.
Also, as a caregiver, don't you think you're the one that's most likely, you're the advocate. You mm-hmm. need to not, you know, in my parents' generation, whatever a doctor did was, okay, that's it. That's the final word, regardless. And that we're, as caregivers, we know how they act. They're not suddenly going to become instantly demented
right.
For no reason.
Mm-hmm.
So
I've had many patients with Alzheimer's, quite a few, where we were called in because the caregivers felt the patient was dying because they weren't eating anymore. They were sleeping all the time. And sometimes that happens with end-stage Alzheimer's. And sometimes we would go in and we would just change the medication. Maybe they were giving them a lot of Ativan. Maybe they were giving him another sedating tranquilizer. And so sometimes we would go in and take them off some of those, put them on different ones, you know, that didn't have that effect on them. And they woke up and started eating and drinking and walking around again. So we would take them off of hospice. So we've seen that too, when people are really medicated inappropriately, and so they put them on hospice and they're not really, you know, that's not really what they need. They really need to get off those drugs.
That's incredible to hear. And that goes to the importance of how hospice is a team. You named off several team members, and that's just so invaluable to have, and that everyone's looking at the person and helping them. And that caregiver, you know, I tell the caregivers, and I learned this from someone else, but you just got to continually be a dementia detective, and you got to continually be watching for their actions and how they're, you know, behaving, and try to help them through those issues and times.
I know, because there's sometimes that instant confusion can indicate that it's a urinary tract infection, not dementia. So we have that in our book. We have a lot of those things to watch out for.
That's very true.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah.
I guess I knew that hospice could be at home or away, but, you know, I never really thought about there being differences. Can one of you go ahead and maybe explain to our listeners what those differences between hospice in your home and a hospice house, I guess it's called, would be?
Well, in our community now, there is a hospice house that's being developed. We haven't had one up to this point, which I'm really excited about, it because not everyone can die in their own home. We have patients that die in skilled nursing facilities, which are definitely not the best place for people to be or die. Assisted living, they do a marginal job. So the hospice house is another great option when people can't be at home. And our hospice house, for example, is in an old home. It's just a lovely setting, beautiful gardens. The people are going to be specifically trained in hospice care, and they're going to work with all of the local hospices. So that it's going to be just really great collaboration. So some hospitals have a hospice house near the hospital or in the hospital, but there are a lot of communities that have separate hospice houses. And so I think this is a great option to explore. Usually the payment probably is private pay on a sliding scale, but there are some hospice houses that have Medicaid funding. They might have some VA beds that are funded by the VA. So, but it's not necessarily covered by hospice. So that would be something to look into.
Yeah, we do have some hospice houses here in North County, San Diego. And in fact, my wife, who's an interior designer, helped with one of the rooms. So I did get to see one firsthand. And as you said, it was, it had lovely gardens out back. The rooms were just all had a different theme. And it was just a really, really nice atmosphere. So it was a pleasure to be able to be part of that indirectly through my wife.
Yeah, it doesn't have the chaos that sometimes someone's personal home might have,
right,
with a lot of people running around and televisions on and, you know, whatever. It's really generally a lovely place.
Now, in that situation, are there medical professionals there around the clock, or somebody must be supervising the house, I would think?
Yeah, usually there's an RN that's there maybe during the daytime. And because if the people are on hospice, which they, most hospice houses, of course, you have to be on hospice. So they would have the hospice nurses coming in and out or working with their patients. Our hospice house is going to have a full-time nurse, and then they're going to have trained nurses aides that are there around the clock. I think there's going to be one aide to four patients, which is really a great, that's a really good ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'll be, other people coming in and out, massage therapists, people to play music, chaplains. And what really makes hospice great are the volunteers. We have probably close to 100 volunteers with our hospice. And I'm sure the hospice house is going to have training for volunteers as well, to sit with the patients, to maybe take them outside, to read to them, just to provide some extra support. And it's really a great experience for the volunteers, too.
It is. Do you find that the volunteers tend to be people who have been through the hospice experience?
Yes, yes.
So they're giving back to that.
Yeah.
That's great. Yana, your book chronicles your journey with your father. How long, you mentioned he was on hospice for 6 months, and maybe you can share some more about your experience and his.
Yeah, like I said, when he was first diagnosed with the bone cancer, it was just, we were all frantic. I was frantic trying to get to the hospital and doctors and giving him pain meds. And then, then he suddenly couldn't walk, and he couldn't even stand up to get in the car. And there was just so much frantic stuff going on. And finally, when we decided, let's just stop all this and let's just go to hospice, it was great that Katie became our hospice social worker, because she was already our friend and knew my father very well. And it was as if, it was so wonderful. Suddenly, our life instantly changed. In one day, all the equipment we needed showed up: a hospital bed, a toilet by the chair, something for the shower. I forgot what that's called, the chair that you sit on.
Shower chair.
Shower chair. Ah, what a clever name.
I'm glad someone said it.
Anyway, I thought it had a over-the-tub kind of thing going on. But it was so great, because suddenly we had, like you were saying, Mike, the team was there. And they were people who knew how to talk to somebody like my father, who was also... he had dementia, and it was starting to get worse and worse. So they made him feel special. So he just became this special person. And what's interesting is through the whole process, Katie talked me and my mother through what was going to happen to my father as he got closer to the end. And so nothing was a surprise. Everything was normal. What the body did was great. She talked about even down to the fact of, in the last hours, there'd be a rash around the body parts that are over organs, sort of the back and the chest, and, that his hands and feet will be cold, and he might, his breathing might be elevated, or he might have a fever. So all of that, when that happened, as he changed, it wasn't frightening. And so we just saw that his body was doing what it was supposed to do, because we were coached all the way through it. And Katie was with us at the end, but we had a nurse, her name is Chris, and she was there, and she's been part of our family now for, several years, she stops in and sees my mother now. It was just, his world got smaller, his family became the hospice family and my mom and myself. It was, his world became just us and a caregiver that we'd hired who my father liked music, so he played the guitar and sang to him a lot.
Oh, that's neat. That's I like to hear that. That must be so. I mean, here the caregivers are with their loved one in such a terrible situation and feeling all alone and, you know, not knowing what to do. And then here comes these, you know, this team in to, with compassion and empathy to help guide you through it. And because I have to imagine you start seeing redness and things appear. I mean, the fear of what it is, the panic that probably comes on that can be, that's unnecessary because it's a normal part of the process. But now they know that because the teams come in to help guide them. That's a great, I never realized that.
Yeah, we have it. We follow it in our book. For people who, we've handed the book out to a number of families and friends who've had loved ones who are dying or have just recently died. And they said that part of the book, understanding exactly what was happening to the body, was really a great help for them because you get panicked that you don't know what you should do. We also have a symptom chapter that if something suddenly, if they're having breathing difficulties or something, what you can do as a caregiver, which is really comforting.
Yeah, and along that lines, you ladies wrote an article that I've shared with the Together in This audience on what happens when a person dies.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible article. Thank you for sharing that with us as well.
Thank you for inviting us to write that article.
You're very welcome. As we wrap up today, ladies, the book has so much more to offer our listeners. Would you like to go ahead and share what some of the other topics are in the book that our listeners will find?
I think one of my favorite chapters is the chapter on care for the caregiver. And I think we have 10 steps on how you can reduce your stress. Because I see one of the biggest problems is that caregivers don't get help soon enough. And that we are there for the caregivers as much as we're there for the patients because they are under incredible stress. And that chapter I really like because it's for the caregiver. It's mm-hmm. It's all about care for the caregiver. And we also have information on the spiritual and emotional journey that people are on, about grief, about the different emotions that you might have and the patient might have. So again, we normalize these feelings and just encourage people to accept what they're feeling and not be judgmental and to just really give themselves the space and the room to feel what they're feeling. So we wanted to include touch on almost everything that we could think of for this manual. So it's just a one book that covers a whole range of topics when you're caring for someone who's dying.
We also have after what happens after death and my husband's brother died last year, and he and his wife really, they didn't ever discuss what his wishes were. So we were at the bedside when he died, and suddenly there was, I mean, she had to decide on the spot in the hospital if he was going to be buried, if he was going to be cremated, if he wanted to donate organs, if they wanted to have a funeral, if they wanted to have just a memorial service. I flipped the book open and went down the list. I was really lucky I go back to it a number of times because I'm a caregiver for my 93-year-old mom right now, and I don't always do the things that we recommend. So I look at that list over and over again, trying to remind myself.
And that is a wonderful aspect of the book, that you can just flip it open to a particular topic. Things are bullet pointed. There's lists. It's easy to read. It's easy to digest. I highly recommend to our listeners to check out the show notes at togetherinthis.com/episode14 for a link to their book called Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers. So that's just a really great, I'm so happy I met you ladies, and I think you're doing wonderful things. Do you have any plans going forward here? Anything on the radar?
We've got a lot of podcasts, and we're planning we're planning on talking to some conferences. So we might be attending some Death with Dignity conference, okay. And because we live in a state that does have Death with Dignity, right. I guess you do too, Mike.
Now, yes, yeah. Yeah. And you tell me how many states that is now.
It's well, let's see, maybe five or so.
Yeah, so we still have a long ways to go.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you, ladies, for joining us, and thank you to our listeners. That was just an incredible conversation and helping me and hopefully our listeners better understand hospice care. I learned a lot. So that concludes the conversation with Yana Beecham and Katie Ortlup. Be sure to visit their website at livingwithdying.com. As I mentioned, you'll find a link to their site, as well as all the reference resources in the show notes at togetherinthis.com, episode 14. If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to hear more, you will also find a link to all past episodes in the show notes. Take care, and I look forward to talking to you in the next episode. Bye now.
Thanks, Mike. It's been great talking with you.
You've been listening to The Alzheimer's Podcast with Mike Good of Togetherness. For more information and to get the resources mentioned in this episode, visit togetherinthis.com/podcast. We'll be right back.